You're listening to Locally Sourced Science, your connection to the scientific discoveries happening in the Finger Lakes community.
Science listeners, my name is Candace Limper, and welcome to Locally Sourced Science. I'm going to be your host for today, and for this week, we decided to explore how natural systems can coincide with people. If you're interested in how we can use science to connect coastal communities, researchers, public agencies, and city officials in Jamaica Bay, then you are in for a treat. Today, our guest, Helen Chang, will talk about her role in connecting professors at Cornell University to people in the New York City coastal communities and the significance of her work. Today's show, you'll also hear about science news and the calendar for this week.
With Locally Sourced Science, I'm Nick Sagerson, here to tell you about some science events happening in the Finger Lakes area from January 6th to January 19th. 2018 marked the 50th anniversary of the historic Apollo 8 mission. On December 21st, 1968, Frank Borman, James Lovell, and William Anders were the first people in human history to leave low Earth orbit, reach the moon, and orbit back before coming home. They were also the first to capture an Earthrise over the moon's horizon. On Thursday, January 10th, you'll be able to hear from planetary scientist Peter Thomas as he recounts how this fateful flight was conceived, how it was executed, including some of his own personal stories, and how it compares to the current climate of space exploration. Peter Thomas received his PhD in geology from Cornell in 1978 and worked at the Cornell Center for Astrophysics and Planetary Sciences until October 2018. There, he studied Mars, satellites, asteroids, and comets. The lecture will be held as part of the Tompkins County Public Library's new series on space theme lectures, and will be hosted by Cornell Astronomy. The lecture will be held at the library on Thursday, January 10th at 5:30 p.m. Did you know that the Finger Lakes area is full of fossils? The lakes are home to numerous fossils from the Ordovician through the late Devonian period, and were buried in the mud and sand somewhere between 450 and 360 million years ago. If you know where to look, you may be able to find brachiopods, clams, trilobites, corals, and cephalopods. And on Saturday, January 12th, from 10 a.m. to noon, the Museum of the Earth will be hosting a Fossil ID Day. So if you found something in your backyard or on a walk around the lake, bring it into the Museum of the Earth and have it examined by an expert who may be able to reveal its history. It's kind of like Antique Roadshow, except the antiques are millions of years old. And speaking of fossils, the Dinomania exhibit at the Syracuse Museum of Science and Technology will be going extinct on the weekend of January 19th. So if you haven't had the chance to see some of the recreations of these 65 million-year-old animals, now is your chance. And those are your science events. With Locally Sourced Science, I'm Nick Sagerson.
Hello, science listeners. My name is Liz Mahood, and I'm here with your science news. First, we announce that Cornell Professor Emeritus of Mathematics, David Henderson, passed away on December 20th. Dr. Henderson's research focused on the geometric features of topology. He was also a dedicated mathematics educator. He advised the theses of over 40 graduate students during his career, as well as explored and wrote curricula for alternative, experiential methods of teaching. Dr. Henderson taught university courses using the Moore method, in which students led discussions without textbooks. He was also a developer of the Algebra Project and several other curricula for K through 12th grade students. As an Ithaca resident, Dr. Henderson also led summer workshops for secondary school teachers at Ithaca High School. He is the author of several books. A memorial service for Dr. Henderson will be held at Annabelle Taylor Hall at 11 a.m. on February 23rd. Next, a recent study, co-authored by Ithaca College professor Matthew Rogers, finds that giving employees Christmas or end-of-year bonuses may actually increase workforce dishonesty. The authors created a simulation that replicated the cost reporting decisions made by managers. They found that when the managers were paid a flat wage, dishonesty decreased with the addition of cost goals, which are targets for reduction in business-related spending. However, when managers are paid a bonus for hitting a specific cost goal target, their simulated dishonesty increased. In real life, this dishonesty is found in actions including falsifying or manipulating financial reporting information, as well as time and expense records. To quote one of the study's co-authors, Virginia Tech professor Bill Becker, "Using purely monetary incentives is almost always a double-edged sword." This study is entitled, "The Effects of Goals and Pay Structure on Managerial Reporting Dishonesty," and was published in the Journal of Accounting, Ethics, and Public Policy. It is freely available for download from the website ResearchGate. I'm Liz Mahood, and that was your science news.
So this is Kitty Gifford with Locally Sourced Science, and today our guest is Helen Cheng. Helen brings her expertise in marine science research and education to her job as a coastal resilience specialist in Jamaica Bay, New York City. This position was created in 2016 as part of a partnership between New York Sea Grant and the Science and Resilience Institute at Jamaica Bay. And here's the Cornell connection. New York Sea Grant is a cooperative program of Cornell University and the State University of New York. So thank you for chatting with us today, Helen.
Thank you for having me.
And so tell me, what brings you to Ithaca and to Cornell this week?
To meet with professors on campus.
We're going to talk a little bit about your work that you're doing over in Jamaica Bay. And I know it's now been your 2-year anniversary in your position as a coastal resilience specialist.
Yes.
So we're curious, what is a coastal resilience specialist and how did you end up in this role?
How I define as a coastal resilience extension specialist is really connecting science and making science usable for coastal communities. Coastal resilience is such a huge topic, and so that ranges from things like promoting stewardship for the ecology of the bay to understanding coastal hazards, education for a lot of the students living in the coastal communities, really connecting that science to people and making that science usable. So I find myself really this conduit between communities, the research community, and researchers, and public agencies and city officials.
Back to that Cornell connection, could you describe it a little bit more? Like, how is your role part of the Cornell University?
I think what I try to do is connect Cornell University professors and their research to the people living in New York City. So a lot of professors here at the university work on New York City issues or has research that's relevant to New York City issues. So there are folks here that work on urban ecology, work on risk communication, and that can be used to influence decision making as well as inform policy, inform land management. So a lot of the research that happens here can be applied in the communities in New York City.
So what would be a typical day for you?
In the office, answering emails, answering phone calls, but there are some days where I'm out in the field talking to people and trying to understand what life is like in their neighborhood and in their community. And those are really rewarding moments when you can have a resident open up to you and talk to you about their life and their concerns and their needs and desires. So I would say a lot of my day-to-day work is listening, and it's been really rewarding when someone can open up to you and just describe their work and their experience in life. I would say that's the typical day-to-day is really talking to people, whether it's in a meeting or in a personal one-on-one interaction or in a webinar on the phone, and it's great.
Do any experiences in particular are ones that you especially like or were really interesting and you love, like maybe you could share one with us?
Yeah, so I was actually in in the community called Canarsie, which is located in Brooklyn, in southern Brooklyn. And I met with a very passionate resident who's lived there pretty much all his adult life. And he was just telling me his experiences during Hurricane Sandy, what areas got flooded, what homes got damaged. He was showing me the landscape. He was sharing his passion for bringing the community together to talk about this issue, to talk about emergency preparedness for whenever that next storm is happening or will happen. And also his desire in STEM education for youth in that neighborhood. And it was really nice for him to open up to me, especially we had only really met one or two times. And it was really great to gather that perspective. And now he's a person that I work with and partner with in terms of understanding what Canarsie is like and what people care about in Canarsie.
So it sounds like you made some inroads in the community in this way with these personal conversations.
Absolutely, yeah.
So let's talk about Jamaica Bay. What is this place? What does it look like? Could you describe it a little for us?
So Jamaica Bay is an urban estuary. It's located in southern Brooklyn, southern Queens. It's the bay that when people fly in and out of John F. Kennedy Airport, where there's a ton of travelers that visit New York City. It's a place that people fly over but don't really acknowledge or know what it is. But it has a very diverse culture, both socially and ecologically. There's a ton of wildlife there. It's a major stopover ground for a lot of migratory birds, especially endangered birds like the mm-hmm. red knot. There are a lot of fish, different communities of fish. My personal favorite, horseshoe crabs, because I studied them in graduate school, as well as different people living alongside this place. So there's a lot of there's life, both people and animals, that live alongside this place in an urban environment like New York City. It's sort of like this unknown hidden jewel that many New Yorkers really don't know about, yet has really a lot of potential in being a place or a model for resilience, and especially resilience in an urban environment.
Mm-hmm. And how would you define resilience in an urban environment?
How I would define it is more if a natural system can coincide with people, where wildlife and communities can live with each other and adapt to different disasters that might happen in the future, mm-hmm. or different changes, rather, major changes that can happen in the future. I guess that's how I would define resilience and being, yeah, and adapting to that.
You've been experimenting with your own podcast.
I have, yes.
And it's called the Jamaica Bay Podcast, and you bring stories about the people that live, work, and play in Jamaica Bay. And in your stories so far, what have you learned about the climate challenges and opportunities being faced there?
Yeah, that's a loaded question. I would say that despite what we see face value, that a lot of people care about climate, a lot of people care about our natural systems, and a lot of people care about each other. You know, I think sometimes, so I've been interviewing researchers, and sometimes I think people view researchers as like someone who sits in a lab all day or someone who sits in an office all day and doesn't interact with anybody. But when I have these conversations with researchers, they really do care a lot about Jamaica Bay, basically. And they also have personal experiences with the bay, as if they were also living there. So they may not be there 24/7, but they have deep connections with Jamaica Bay. And so there's something that them and the communities can relate to. That's been the biggest thing I've learned while doing this podcast series.
As we speak today, the Northeast is experiencing another winter storm.
Oh boy.
And there is is a coastal flood advisory in effect along Jamaica Bay.
Mm-hmm.
For a dense urban coastal area like Jamaica Bay, what does the future look like in the face of climate change?
So this is what I would view as the future, is that people are more aware of the climate and that it is changing, and people are knowledgeable about those changes, taking actions to address those changes, either big or small. I would say that's where I see the future of this, is that these communities, both big and small, and the people that live in it, diverse however they may be, acknowledges that this is happening, that it can impact their well-being and livelihood, but there are actions that they can do to adapt to it. That it is not the end of the world, that we can live together and coincide with these natural happenings. And that there is information out there that we can use to influence our decisions to adapt to this.
I also wanted to circle back to the podcast. I listened to your podcast about the horseshoe crabs,
mm-hmm.
which is an area that you researched for your master's degree.
Mm-hmm.
And it is one of those interesting phenomena of the world. So what does the horseshoe crab migration look like in Jamaica Bay?
So during late spring to early summer, typically around May and June of the year, depending on the year, horseshoe crabs start migrating onto shore to mate and spawn. So it's really one of those, you think about mass migrations like the Serengeti, or it's something that even like a teenager or a kid even can even experience in their own backyards in an urban environment. It's almost really magical when you see something that has been happening for millions and millions of years happen right in front of you. It's really touching to see someone make that connection and be in awe of it. I try not to nerd out about it because I did study them for 3 years or more. And it's really an annual spectacle that has been happening since dinosaurs walked the earth. And so they'll start migrating onto shore. Usually it's two horseshoe crabs, one piggybacking the other. On the back of one is typically a male. So it's usually a female doing all the work, dragging a male onto shore.
No surprise there.
Yeah. The female will dig a nest in the sand, start laying her eggs, and then the male behind her inseminate the eggs or inseminate the nest. Sometimes you'll see clusters of horseshoe crabs, and it's usually a lot of males surrounding one female, and the males that are surrounding her but not attached to her are called satellite males. So they're all trying to inseminate this nest where there's this one horseshoe crab trying to just do her thing. And to see it so close to you, I feel like when you think of nature documentaries or animal documentaries, you think of this like it's so hidden. You can't mm-hmm. see it unless you like travel to the Antarctic or you travel down to the deep ocean. But this is something that happens in people's backyards even. Or their local beach. It's really fascinating.
So do you find that there's a lot of opportunities when this is migration is happening? People can find some places to do a viewing and get a sense of what's going on?
Absolutely. So people can, there are organizations out there that do walks to witness this spectacle. There are also opportunities to even participate in research with horseshoe crabs. So there are groups that do surveys to count horseshoe crabs along the beach and keep a track of them year after year to kind of look for trends in their populations. There are also opportunities to tag horseshoe crabs, and that helps to understand where horseshoe crabs are moving, see which ones come back to the same beach or if they move to a different beach. So there's ways to see this happen year after year, but also to help with the research of horseshoe crabs and really take part in that.
I want to go check it out.
Yes, absolutely. I'll take you there.
Excellent. Did we leave anything out? Is there anything else we forgot to mention or you'd like to add?
I think the biggest thing is that when people think of New York City, they think of business and Wall Street, fashion, design, but people leave out or people don't really acknowledge that New York City is a coastal city There is about 520 miles of coastline, and almost half the city is surrounded by water. Manhattan is an island, and so you think about how much happens in Manhattan, and you don't think about, oh, wow, it's an island, and it can be susceptible to a lot of things at islands when we think of islands, right? So I think that's one thing that a lot of people don't acknowledge. But it's also a place that holds a lot of potential to not only be viewed as like this urban megatropolis, but also as this natural place that people can visit the parks there. People can see wildlife there. I don't think people realize that. And I think the biggest thing is that Jamaica Bay is part of Gateway National Recreation Area, which is part of National Park Service. So technically, New York City has a national park in it.
Right in their backyard.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the most visited national parks of the country.
Wow.
And that can
be. I did not know that.
Yeah. It can be compared to Yellowstone or the Grand Canyon. It gets as many visitors, if not more, than those parks. Also, it's probably the only park, if I'm not mistaken, that has public transportation that goes through it. So the subway goes through it. There are several buses that go to it. So it's pretty amazing, I think. If you're ever there and you're on the area and in Jamaica Bay, you don't feel like you're in the city unless you see the skyline. And it's just kind of amazing to have these two opposites coexist with each other.
I'm so glad I asked that. I learned a little bit more about what it's like there.
Yeah.
So, well, thank you so much,
Helen. Thank you.
This was really fun. And it was interesting to hear about the reach of Cornell University research.
Absolutely.
In Jamaica Bay and in an urban environment. So that was really cool to chat with you a little bit about this stuff.
Yeah.
No Thanks.
Problem. Thank you.
Hi, this is Daniel Goldman for Locally Sourced Science. For a Science in the Classroom segment, I attended a class full of New York State teachers. On a chilly April Saturday, around 24 teachers gathered for a Foldscope workshop organized by an outreach effort on campus called ACET. What's a Foldscope, you ask? Well, it's a microscope that is folded from a piece of paper. To lead the workshop, the co-creator of Foldscope and the CEO of Foldscope Instruments, Dr. Jim Cebulski, was present to make sure no teacher left the building without a fully functional, paper-based, cheap, like dirt cheap, microscope. Jim and the company are making a push into classrooms, the ideal playground for $1 paper-based microscope, and they're doing it with a series of workshops and demonstrations around the world. What immediately strikes about attending these workshops with teachers is the love teachers have for what they do, how much they care about the students, their desire to go above and bring what they can to classrooms, even with limited resources, and their passion for teaching. Here are some stories told as part of the introduction, stories of what brought teachers to the workshop and what they wanted to get out of it as takeaways. Have a listen.
It would be great for me because I'm on the go all the time. So if I could bring the kids right outside with the microscopes, it would definitely be beneficial.
Hi, I'm Marilyn Mayer and a recently retired teacher from Ithaca and a former student. Corrine up there. I kid that I'm kind of the dummy factor because I'm not a science background person. I and Mary Kay do outreach into elementary classrooms, so I'm especially heartened to see teachers who want to bring science into the elementary grades because that really is where you can get kids at a very formative age excited about science. We recently did all of the third grades at a local school, and that's the youngest we've done the lessons on, and they were absolutely gaga.
Next, Jim Cebulski demonstrates how to fold a microscope from a piece of paper. It takes a few minutes. Let's see how he does it.
This is the part that you start the assembly with. And so you can look in the instructions or you could look at this part. It has a silver side and a black side. But this is actually two parts. And also there's these four registration holes along one edge here. There's 8 folds you need to make as you're assembling this part. So just make sure you do all 8 folds, not only 6 or 7 or 5 of them. The only reason that we have red color on this design is to give you an indicator as to how you should fold things. And at that point, once you reach this point, there's only 4 steps left. So that's the good news. So I'm going to take the T-shaped piece, which is the lens holder, put that on top of the other assembly, which has the slide holder, slide stage. And I'm going to place it so that the window on the top, you have it right over top of the logo. So the logo is visible through that little window in the top. And before viewing the slide, you want to take a look at the sample right over top of the lens, okay? If it's located way over there, you're not going to be able to see the sample. You want it right over top of the lens. Then you can close the clip. And the way that we view the fold scope, again, always viewing from the blue side. The light comes in from the yellow side, you view from the blue side.
After a round of oohs and ahs, with several wows in between, the consensus around the room is clear.
I got it. Oh, but no. Yeah, you got it. I'm almost
no, it's, I think the magnet holds it in place.
I just realized it's
perfect. Can I see your thing? You said it was left in here. I didn't even realize. Oh, okay. So I'm not sure how that
works. Is this the first time you looked through this?
Through this, yes. Yeah, through this.
And what was your impression?
Oh, it's fabulous. Yeah, no, it's fabulous.
Question, is it your first time looking at
it? Yeah, yeah, I've never seen one of these
how
before.
How was the experience?
It's pretty cool. I mean, it's really neat to be able to have a piece of paper and be able to see something that you otherwise wouldn't be able to see with, you know, essentially paper. And a little piece of glass. So that's cool. That's really cool. I like that part of it.
And you were able to see images through your fold scope?
I was. Okay. I don't know what I'm looking at, but
does
I saw
it say?
Things. It's some sort of fish something.
Oh, that came from that box?
Yep. It's tissue from
they're,
fish samples.
They're fish embryos that were... So they're small fish that were put in the block. And then section finally.
Yeah.
And then they had the dye so that put it on a slide. And you could see through a thin section of fish cells. So I don't know if you'd be able to see it. It should be a single fish in development. I don't know
right.
if you'd be able to
tissue.
Figure out the parts.
Tissue.
Yeah, earth scientists. So no.
But you could see cells and tissues. Yeah.
And fishy things, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my God, they're stuffed.
Yeah, they're completely stuffed.
Yeah, yeah, they do that. This is Vorax, so that's one of the
big ones.
Yeah, that's one of the monsters. Oh. But look at that! Look how full he is of the Chlamydomonas.
Well, there were two that zoomed by. Are those just the one that hasn't.
But see, look, he's eating right there. You can see him. See him eating that one?
Yeah, he's gouging
yeah.
down.
Yeah,
on.
Yeah. Oh, that's really cool. Look, he's just this is Vorax
sample, right?
Eating Chlamydomonas.
Oh wow!
Yeah, he just ate. He literally just ate one. That was cool. Look how fat he is. You can actually see him ingest it. That would be a great teaching tool, you know, watching that ingestion in a live organism.
I have been fortunate to be using Foldscope for several years, along with advanced microscopes and tools that are part and parcel of a job in the lab. For teachers, however, a cheap and reliable instrument is a must if they're to demonstrate what a living microbe looks like. If they convey the life that is not seen to the eye. And a workshop like the one in April may just be the right catalyst needed to get the teachers started on life-changing lessons with hands-on learning. For more information on Foldscopes and to get one, go to www.foldscope.com.
And that wraps up this week's episode for Locally Sourced Science. Nick Segerson provided the calendar, Liz Mahood gave us the news, Kitty Gifford interviewed Helen Chang, and Daniel Colbin covered Foldscapes. We would like to thank Ben Jordan and ECM for the music. If you'd like to hear more about locally sourced science, or if you have questions or topics you'd like to hear about, please feel free to reach us at our website at locallysourcedscience.org or tweet at us on Twitter at FLX Science Radio. And this is Candace Limper, your host for today, and I'm signing out.